nation. Bodies in the basement. Bodies all around. Bodies in the basement. And the killer can't be found. Bodies, bodies, from the ceiling to the ground. Bodies, bodies, and the killer can't be found. That's Bodies in the Basement, special request from Stray Dog. Stray Dog, where are you at? You down the basement, man? Yeah, Stray Dog. He's been real busy this summer. He'll be back to do some shows probably this fall when the snow starts flying. Yeah, so that's Bodies in the Basement here on the 27th of August, 2014. Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Well, I sent a letter back out to our local newspaper again and to comment on a couple of things. Wanted to comment on that offer I got from that Christian Zionist who wants to take me to Israel on an all-expense-paid trip. Here's my letter to the editor. Dear editor, I see your kindergarten leaders in Indianapolis, the state capital, have done it again. The Secretary of State, who I believe is a Republican, has decided Indiana parents can't restrict the young from puffing on an electric cigarette. So our liberty-loving master has stepped in to take over parental duties. It would seem the Secretary of State should concentrate on his own legislators to quit smoking, because I know a lot of them do here in Indiana. Another Republican, Governor Pence, is blocking the gambling boats from transferring to land-based property. In other words, a lot of those barges or boats they have for gambling are getting older, and they want to come up on the shore and build a gambling casino. I guess the poor in the working class will gamble more on dry land than on a barge. So the government wants to stop them from gambling on dry land. Maybe that's got something to do with Christianity or something. Personally, I think gambling is a big ripoff, mostly of the poor, but it's been around for thousands of years. It'll probably stay around, but. That's a crazy-ass governor. He says, they're okay on the water. I mean, tied up at the dock. But they can't move into a building on shore. That's a weird situation. This guy wants to run for president, too. Mike Pence. He came out of the talk show business, out of the radio business, and got himself in as governor, and then now he's really going to town. Incidentally, to my Christian Zionist friend, I accept your free trip to the Holy Land. I need a diversion. Maybe I'll do one of those become a rabbi in 24 hours gig. You know, you can do that. Oops, I erred. I'm already a rabbi certified in the Universal Life Church by the leader of that church, Kirby Hensley. August 12, 1986, I had this certificate hanging on my wall. Yeah, forgot about it. So I have my papers. If I get in a jam, I can call on Israel's chief rabbi. His name's Metzger, too. In fact, some of the right wing like to get on my ass about that. You must be a Jew. You must be a Jew. Well, Metzger means butcher in German. So anyhow, that should get me right into all those top places. Maybe I'll get to talk to Nitwit if I get over there. So I'm calling this guy out. Put your money where your mouth is. All expense paid trip plus $500 spending money. Going to show me about it. I'd like to go over there and go around and take pictures of all the Jew slums in Israel, where Jews are having a hard time making it, can't get enough to eat, and and all kinds of other problems, and see how that's going. Well, we've got a comment on the subject of autism today from one of our associates. Autism characteristics include a complete lack of prejudice. Therefore, autistic people must have a handler to defend themselves from predators, among other things. I suspect that the government is causing a mild autism in society under the justification for multiculturalism and tolerance by such means as vaccines. They have no fear using GMOs if they think it's advantageous, while knowing that those can cause problems they cannot predict. Modern American social schemes are predicated on the individuals, white, reserve no fear of anything foreign, it seems to me. An interesting fact, 10% of Europeans have complete immunity to AIDS, and only Europeans have this condition. If a version of AIDS were modified to be airborne, it could wipe out the entire world population except those Europeans with immunity. However, it would kill 90% of them. Well, that's interesting. Well, have you heard about Jewish illegal aliens and Jewish illegal immigration? You don't hear about that, do you? No, they don't want to talk about that. And so you'll find out why Jews love illegal immigration and immigration of all these other races in the United States and other places. It causes confusion in any culture or any society. But I'm going to play you a radio program here based on a book. And I would call this Jewish Sources. It's called After They Closed the Gates, Jewish Illegal Immigration to the United States from 1921 to 1965. Now, this, I don't believe, was written by a Jew. But anyhow, I don't know exactly what she's going to say, but we're going to play it on here, okay? All right. First of all, I got to...
Well, it kind of took me on, I think. I started...
No, I need to rewind you.
As I think a lot of historians do, with a completely different...
Hold it.
...removed from that designation. Immigration quotas set in the early 1920s and lasting into the 1960s strictly limited Jewish immigration to the United States from Southern and Eastern Europe. In the face of those laws, people tried to get in anyway. Some were arrested and deported. Others were smuggled in successfully, and while we may look back at their entry as heroic, that's certainly not how they would have been viewed by the laws of the time. Garland's book is called After They Closed the Gates, Jewish Illegal Immigration to the United States, 1921 to 1965. We're delighted to have Libby with us in the studio to talk about it. Libby Garland, welcome to Vox Tablet.
Thank you.
Libby, why did you decide to take on this subject?
Well, it kind of took me on, I think. I started, as I think a lot of historians do, with a completely different project. So I imagined that I was going to do some research into the work of Jewish aid organizations, which in the 1920s were working, as they had been for a while, were working internationally. And these Jewish aid organizations suddenly had to sort of take on new roles during and after World War One, when their European counterparts were just sort of in this difficult and disastrous set of circumstances. So I was interested in the ways that Jews in the U.S. were taking the lead and making connections internationally.
And how did it take this shift to look at illegal immigration?
Well, I absolutely wasn't thinking about immigration at all, because those laws that you already made reference to, these laws in 1921 and 1924 that drastically reduced, that were designed to drastically reduce immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, because the people coming from those places were sort of widely believed to be inferior to earlier immigrants from Western and Northern Europe. So I already knew that those laws had been so effective that I wasn't going to be finding really anything in my archival sources to do with immigration. And what happened was that as I started sort of trying to trace the activities of these aid organizations, and in particular as I was using government documents to do that, I kept sort of stumbling into these reports of, in fact, ongoing immigration even after these really restrictive laws, and in particular of acts of violating the immigration laws by coming, sneaking over the borders illegally.
And that kind of piqued your interest.
Yeah, so there were all these really wacky stories, or to me wacky because I utterly didn't expect them, of people who were going to nearby countries like Cuba or Mexico or Canada in the hopes of making it into the United States eventually, sometimes on the promises of shipping companies, ticket agents who told people that was sort of an easy backdoor in, and then getting busted when they crossed the border. And so these records of those busts ended up in the official files at the National Archives, although not sort of listed anywhere in any obvious way. They're sort of tucked into files about other issues as well. So I was sort of running into them somewhat by accident, but also frequently. So I kept kind of coming across these really strange and compelling stories about people who were stuffed into the bottom of a boat from Cuba to Miami with a bunch of bootleg liquor, because this was also the era of prohibition, and then sort of officials, U.S. officials, discussions about what to do about this sort of new, strange turn of events.
Let's back up a minute. Can you tell us a little bit more about the immigration laws of 1921 and 1924? What did they stipulate exactly?
So these laws together, the laws of 1921 and 1924, are often referred to by historians and were referred to at the time as quota acts. And they were so-called because they did something that U.S. immigration law had never done before, which was to put a numerical restriction on most, although not all, immigration. So in other words, the United States Congress passed these laws that set a cap on the total number of immigrants who could come in subject to these laws, and assigned nation-by-nation quotas for most of the world. There were places in the world that were exempt, namely Western Hemisphere countries, but these quotas were specifically geared at limiting immigration from places that were thought of as the sources of racially, politically, culturally inferior immigrants.
And of course, it goes without saying that this is all happening at a time when in Europe there are these huge waves of nationalist tendencies and xenophobic laws being put in place there.
Absolutely, right. So for people who were in these sort of newly nationalist places that had been kind of, that were rising up out of the ashes of World War I, the stakes in leaving, if they were part of a minority population in one of those places, was, those stakes were high, and people still had really pressing reasons economically, politically, and so on to come to the United States, as well as often really powerful reasons in the United States to come. In other words, they had friends and relatives to come to and hopes for employment and so on.
And well, the historians of this period have generally seen the passage of these quota laws with the staunching of Jewish immigration, the closing of the gates, as you suggest in your title. But your research found that the gates weren't entirely closed.
Right. So the official data gathered by the U.S. government in the wake of those laws is so compelling when you look at it in the aggregate, right? So it's so clear when you look at the numbers of people being counted entering the country that those numbers declined drastically. But I think historians have really long taken those laws at their word, in a sense. So the laws were passed and they did what they set out to do. But while that's true to some extent, I mean, I don't want to say that they weren't effective. They were. They put very effective barriers in place for people to come. But at the same time, as we know very well from our sort of current day universe, just the fact that you have laws in place to bar people from entering the country doesn't mean that they're not going to do their best to come anyway, and that's exactly what happened.
Jewish American leaders found themselves in a particularly sticky position vis-a-vis these quota laws. On the one hand, they had members of the Jewish community coming to them begging for help to get relatives out of war-torn Europe. On the other hand, they were under pressure to demonstrate strict adherence to the laws to avoid reinforcing any stereotypes of Jews as having divided loyalties. I'd love it if you could tell us about one such communal leader who you talk about in the book, Rabbi Martin Zilanka, who was in a very tough spot in El Paso.
Yeah, he's a great character. I think of him as Rabbi Martin Zilanka, but I don't actually know how we pronounce his name. So Rabbi Zilanka, who was the rabbi of the Reform synagogue in El Paso, was not living in somewhere that was considered to really be a center of Jewish life, right? So this was a town which had about 2,000 Jewish residents, and he had come there to be the rabbi in around 1900 from Cincinnati, where he grew up and went to rabbinical seminary. But he found himself suddenly on the front lines of this issue of Jewish immigrants coming over the border illegally, because he was in El Paso, and because El Paso was then, as now, one of the major border crossings from Mexico into the United States, and because one of the main routes that people trying to skirt these quota laws were taking was via Mexico. So they would come in on a ship into Veracruz, for example, and then make their way north and try to come in through El Paso. So he was suddenly confronted with a bunch of people, and this was actually in 1921, even before the first quota law got passed, but as people were starting to get news that these laws were pending, and so trying to sort of rush their way in, he got news that people had crossed the border illegally, and in fact, the way that he got this news was that four such immigrants showed up in his study. And so he was suddenly confronted with these actual people who had come over this border, and he didn't know what to do. So he wrote to this colleague of his, who was a rabbi in Galveston, Texas, and asked this rabbi, Rabbi Cohen, what the right course of action was with these immigrants. So Zilanka knew that they had come from really difficult circumstances. He understood that they were coming from war-torn Europe. He admired them for making their way, sort of all that way on their own and making it over the border. But he was deeply worried that this would look really bad for American Jews in a time in which the American Jewish community was facing all sorts of both formal and informal anti-Semitism. So he ultimately came down on the side of the law, and even though he felt really sorry for these folks, he felt that even more important than helping them was maintaining the reputation of American Jews as being law-abiding and upstanding citizens of the nation in which they lived. So he became a sort of interesting figure, because on the one hand, people continued to turn to him for advice and help, and on the other hand, he put an enormous amount of time and effort into trying to stop the flow of Jews over that border. And he did this in a few ways, but one of the ways he did it was by setting up a kind of settlement house, a center for Jews in Mexico City, whose purpose was to try to help them settle in Mexico. So if they had come to Mexico with the aim of getting themselves over the border, Zilanka's hope was that they would actually reconsider and try to settle down. He tried to help them find employment, get in touch with their relatives in the United States so they could get money if they needed it. And that was sort of his solution to the problem. He was not entirely successful, although he did manage to raise money for that center in Mexico City, but folks continued to come over that border.
On the flip side of people like Rabbi Zilanka, there were smugglers. They took a different approach. Who were the smugglers, and how extensive were their operations?
Well, that is a question that the government officials at the time would have loved to be able to answer definitively.
Uh-huh.
And I'm, of course, mostly relying on their sources, which are both full of holes because there were things they didn't know. And I think sometimes perhaps also a little bit suspect, because some of those government officials may have, you know, they had some incentive to make the problem seem really daunting so that the officials didn't seem incompetent at being able to, not being able to solve the problem. But that said, in the records that I was looking at, there were lots of really extensive investigations that suggested that the smuggling business was booming in places like Havana and in Mexico, but also overseas in Warsaw and Berlin, for example. Some of the folks involved in smuggling were naturalized American citizens, so they were people who had ties in the old country and also could speak various languages. A lot of the descriptions of them suggest that they were fluent in multiple languages, which is an incredible resource for them in their work with people coming from lots of places. And their citizenship let them cross U.S. borders easily.
Let me just understand something about these quota laws and how they worked. If you were in Europe and you wanted to come to the United States legally, did you just get on a ship and come here and then sort of, let's see what happens when I get to Ellis Island and maybe I'll get in and maybe I'll get sent back? Or did you already know whether you were permitted to enter the United States in Europe?
Right, that's actually a really important question. So one of the things that the 1924 law did in particular was really move the decision-making about who was going to get visas entirely overseas, so that people knew before they set out whether they had that permission to come in. And there were people, there was still a sort of lively application process going on in Europe, both for people to come in under the existing quotas or to come in as somebody who was exempt from the quota. So there were certain categories of people who were exempt from the quota, so children under a certain age, for example. But that very fact also meant that there were opportunities for playing fast and loose with the law already in Europe. For example, there were rabbis in small towns who would traffic in fake birth certificates so that somebody could seem to be a minor, a child under the age of 18, even though in fact they were 21 or 22, for example. So there were people who obtained kind of legal, seemingly legal documents and came in through the front door who in fact had obtained those documents in all kinds of backdoor ways.
I don't think when we think about Jewish immigration right now that most Jews think of their relatives, their grandparents or great-grandparents, as having been illegal aliens. Why is this chapter of American Jewish history so invisible?
I would say a couple things to that. One is that, interestingly, I think a lot of people do know that their families have these stories. And as I was doing my research and presenting it and talking about it in various places, I myself was surprised at how many people would listen and then sort of pipe up that, oh, in fact, their grandfather, uncle, whoever, had a really similar story. I think that what became really interesting to me hearing all those stories just sort of cropping up without my even looking for them was that people didn't think of those stories as part of a larger history. And I think in that sense, there are lots of individual families who know that their relative has some such dramatic story, but they think of it as one dramatic, crazy story in their family history and not as part of a larger history of the American Jewish community. And so I think for me, the question became, why is that larger story so invisible?
And why is it?
Well, I mean, I think the answers are kind of complicated, but I would put them in two categories. And one category has to do with the way that the spotlight, I think, shifted to other groups besides Europeans in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and beyond. And specifically, Mexicans, who, interestingly, were not limited by those initial laws, increasingly became defined as sort of a quintessential illegal aliens. And there's a whole sort of complicated story about how that came to be. Some of it has to do with ideas about race. Some of it has to do with sort of the workings of labor in the Southwest and West of the United States. But so the sort of suspicion that had been directed at other groups, I think, came to be increasingly directed toward people from Mexico. So I think that's one story. Another story has to do with the kind of gradual erasure of the illegalness of Jewish illegal immigration and European illegal immigration more generally. So by the late 1930s and then increasingly during and after World War II, there were various shifts in law and the administration of immigration law that kind of gave people, they weren't wholesale amnesties exactly, but they provided loopholes and means for people who had come in illegally to regularize their status. And after the war as well, I think the new category of war refugees, which sort of became a legal immigration category for the first time after World War II, helped to legitimize European immigration in general and Jewish immigration in particular in certain kinds of ways, although there was plenty of dislike of and suspicion of folks who were coming in as refugees. But I think that there's another piece of that story of erasing the history of Jewish illegal immigration, which was that the American Jewish community itself was deeply concerned to sever the connection between illegal alienness and Jews, Jewish immigrants or Jewish Americans, and undertook various political projects to make sure that that connection was, or to do their best to make sure that that connection didn't stick. So, for example, in the 1920s and 1930s, there were many proposals to make all aliens, meaning non-naturalized foreigners, register with the government to obtain ID in various forms and to present that ID on demand. And Jews were really instrumental in the fight against such legislation, whose purpose was definitely to root out illegal aliens and be able to deport them, so much like the Arizona and Alabama laws that have come into force recently. And Jews organized very effectively, along with other ethnic groups and the ACLU, to battle those laws that they saw as measures that would have really cemented the connection between illegal immigration and their communities more broadly. I also think that there is a really deep investment on the part of the American Jewish community broadly in the, as you were saying, in the story of our immigrant forebears as being a heroic story and a really admirable story. And so the story of our immigrant grandfathers and great uncles and great aunts is that one that we are collectively proud of, that we see as a story about perseverance, about escape from hardship, about a collective sacrifice that people made for the good of their families and their children. And I think that that story clashes in important ways with all the meanings that have over time become attached to the idea of illegal aliens, right? Which sounds shady and negative.
As you mentioned, illegal immigration is a hot button issue now, but it has been for some time. I don't think anybody on either side of the political spectrum would disagree. What can or should we take from your research that might inform how we think about that debate?
I would say a couple things. One is, I'm always struck by how in the political debate, when people are talking about the immigration system and what is to be done with it, that this phrase gets tossed around, which is that the immigration system is broken. And to me, that implies that at one point it was working well and that something went wrong, right? It broke. Whereas in reality, I think, you know, what I hope that this book suggests is that, in fact, the system was broken to begin with, or, you know, or else that it's sort of functioning exactly the way it's always functioned, which is that it's always been a struggle between those who would enforce the laws and those who want to get where they're going. Another thing I would say about sort of the immigration system and what I hope that the book begins to lay out for readers is that things that seem very natural to us now about the system of immigration that we have. So the idea that we need to limit how many immigrants come in, the idea that it is part of national security to guard our borders, the idea that some immigrants or that a sort of unrestricted flow of immigrants would be a threat to the United States, the idea that we have borders that are patrolled and controlled and guarded and watched over, all those ideas, I think, have come to seem really obvious to us. We would not imagine coming into John F. Kennedy Airport without having to stand in line and show our passports. But that, in fact, all those things have a history. That not so long ago, nobody was counting who came over the border from Mexico into the United States, for example. And my students, when I teach this issue, are always really surprised that the official immigration data the U.S. government was gathering didn't even note border crossings until into the 20th century. So I guess I hope another thing that the book suggests is that all these things are so much part of the immigration debate today have a history, and that they, all of these sort of ideas about border control and the means of enforcing it evolved in contest with people who continued to insist on being able to get where they were going. And I guess the last thing I would say is that the book is a response to something that I've heard people say. I used to, when I was in graduate school, one of the things I did to pay my rent was to give historical walking tours on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And that was a tour that Jewish groups, for example, from Long Island or elsewhere would come and do as a way of thinking about their own family's history and the history of immigration and sort of that neighborhood as a center of that story of Jewish immigration. And one of the things that I heard people say fairly often was that their grandparents or parents or uncles or aunts had done immigration differently than people do it today, that they had done it right, that they had come in the right way, they had come in legally and they had worked their way up, and saw a real distinction between their own family histories and the stories of immigration they might be seeing on or reading in the news today. And I think that that this book is something of an answer to that, right? That like the Jewish immigrants who were coming either legally or illegally or in some gray area in between sometimes in the 1920s were not so different from people coming in illegally or legally or in some gray area in between in the here and now. And I think that puts into perspective some of the stuff that, you know, we hear in the political debates raging in Congress, for example.
Libby Garland, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Speaking with us.
Thank you.
Libby Garland is an assistant professor of history at Kingsborough Community College in Brooklyn. Her book is called After They Closed the Gates, Jewish Illegal Immigration to the United States, 1921 to 1965.
Well, I hope that wasn't too loud. I haven't been able to play it back, but I couldn't, the way I was running the audio, I couldn't turn the volume down, the input volume, so if it's too bad, I can always come back and recopy and do it again using a different way about. So anyhow, if it's too loud, I'll try to bear with it. But anyhow, you see important things in that book review. Number one, every time the white race goes into war, it causes upheaval. World War One, of course, the War of 1848, in Germany and so forth, that caused massive immigration, which fed the Union Army in its struggle with the Confederacy. That's where they were getting all their fresh new troops from, Ireland and Germany and all over the place, that were destabilized because of the war in Germany. You see, every time a white race gets in war, it screws things up much worse. So then by the time World War One came along, and they had the same thing after World War One with all these people trying to pour in here, trying to flee the crap and, you know, destruction in Europe to get into the United States. And of course, along with this program, you can see why Jews are so friendly to the idea of immigration. They're extremely sympathetic to immigration. One of the reasons is this is the way they can move their conspiracies across borders easily. Like she didn't talk about organized crime and all that, Cosa Nostra and all that, the Black Hand and everything that came in here under the skirts of Italian people and others. And then, of course, the rise of Murder Incorporated, which was a Jewish kike operation. all coming out of destabilizing areas, you see. Many cases these people are sort of put off on their own reservation and they're doing okay, and then we destabilize the whole thing through warfare, and away they go. Everybody goes every which way. And so who does this? Well, it's a military-industrial complex and the corporations, but more the military-industrial complex, and of course religions play a role in it and the whole bit. Anyhow, so and then after World War II, they were given special status, being a persecuted minority or war refugee. They were coming in here from all over the place. Under the war effort, they could keep a lot of the Jews out for national security during the war, which they did reject a lot of immigration from Jews, but they snuck in through Canada, they snuck in through Mexico, just like any other wetback. But they don't want to admit why they're so friendly to immigration, because that's their method of getting out of town when things go shitty. Now, part of that would be natural. If things go crappy, even if you're not causing things to go crappy, you want to get out of town like these Muslims. We go over there and tear the shit out of the Middle East, and what do? Give me some money, I'm going to get on a plane and go to America. And then we say, well, why are you coming here? Well, of course you're coming here because we're blowing the shit out of your country. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable the status and the outlook of most of these Republicans. Not to just pick on the Republicans, but they're always behind all the any kind of warfare because they've always got a good excuse. Yeah, we're going to nation build or we're going to regime change because we don't like that leader. And since all the countries of the world now are provinces of the American Empire, yes, that's what it is. The United States has become the empire, and it expects all the provinces to obey what we want them to do. If they don't obey what we want them to do, well, we send out the legions like Rome did and kick their ass. And we can blame it right back on ourselves, and all these damn conservative right-wing Republicans are the worst. I mean, the Democrats would be crazy. They can go for a lot of stuff. But the Republicans, for the most part, are the ones who never saw a war they didn't like. So there you go. You've got the, now you know the basics of why the Jews got in here like mad. War of 1848, First World War, Second World War, massive movements of people. And so the Jews just hid among the rest of the people and came on in. So a lot of right-wingers who claim to be racist and anti-Jewish don't seem to want to fess up and admit what our government and our system has done. And almost everything that's bad for the white race has been created right out of Washington, D.C. and Wall Street. And they still make excuses for it. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Well, it's believable because it's happening every day. And I told you over and over again, if you want to know what the Jews are up to, just listen to them. They'll tell you. There's plenty of Jewish stuff. Newspapers from Israel, radio shows from Israel. They brag. The Jews are big braggarts. For the right wing to say, oh, it's a big conspiracy, we don't know what they're doing. Bullshit. They brag about it. They write books about it. They promote books that other people wrote. So whenever a conservative right-wing con man tries to tell you that, it's all secret, it's a secret cabal, and nobody knows what's going on, what they're doing, and but listen to me because I got it from who's got a right-wing radio show. Tell them they're full of shit. Well, you've heard about the Burning Man ceremony and pagan fun that they have out there in, I think it's Nevada. Well, now they got it over in Israel. I guess they got some pagan Jews over there. More than 3,000 people had already encircled the effigy of the man in a temporary desert city in the Negev desert for the last ecstatic climax to a five-day Israeli Burning Man festival. It was a wanton ceremony of fire twirlers and African drums, marking the first time Israel hosted a regional event that was officially sanctioned by the yearly Burning Man Festival in Nevada. So the people in Nevada have sanctioned this ceremony and burning of the Burning Man over in Israel. Yet, after months of negotiations, prior approvals from a litany of fire marshals, building engineers, and practically every bureaucratic safety official in the Negev region, at the last moment, police yanked permission to burn the art installations. It threatened to become a Burning Man festival without the actual burning of the man. It's probably too little, too difficult for the police to swallow, said one burner, dressed in an enormous fuzzy robe and top hat and blinking lights as he gazed up at the effigy that would not burn. Quote, which is funny because they have no problem with kids making enormous dangerous bonfire piles before Lag Omer, he laughed, after slinking away into the desert darkness towards the techno music booming out the Jungle Vibes camp. Now, the U.S. version of the Burning Man, every August, like this week, some 60,000 people create a massive city in the middle of the Black Rock Desert for 7 days with hundreds of art installations and the burning of a 90-foot man. The festival has spun from a small fringe community into a worldwide movement, with regional burns happening in countries across the world. The Israeli version began after a group of Israelis who had attended the Nevada festival got together and decided to bring the spirit of the Burning Man to Israel. Well, that's straight out paganism, so evidently the rabbis in Israel put a kibosh on burning the Burning Man in the middle of the desert. That reminds me when they wouldn't let us play music and have big bonfires up in California, Central California that time. Said if we played any skinhead music or had any bonfires that they'd throw us all in jail. So, well, you know, another thing I was thinking about, you know, hundreds, perhaps thousands of Russians poured into Israel there at the fall of the Soviet Union. Now, the Israelis know, and I've heard that, hell, a lot of those people weren't Jews, and of course, even the ones that say they are, you know, say they have proof they are Jews, they're not real Semites, you know. But I wonder how much effect these Russian Jews are going to have on the infrastructure of Israel as time goes on, because we know that some of them have even started Nazi groups in Israel. So it's interesting. It might be interesting to see what the Russian, basically whites, that observe the Jewish, or say they observe the Jewish religion just to get into Israel and out of Russia, are going to do to politics, you know, politics in Israel. It's going to be interesting. Behind the scenes, there's things happening that we probably don't know about. So, anyhow, so much for The Burning Man. That's a great movie, you know. What the hell's the name of that movie? Anyhow, a British movie where the cop goes over to this island to investigate the so-called disappearance of a little girl, and he's investigating it like a homicide, and actually what happened was they lured him over there just so he could be the person that died when they burnt their Burning Man that year for a festival, so they'd have good crop yields on the island. And so in the end they put this cop in this giant man and set him on fire. Anyhow, what the hell was the name of that? I can't remember the name of that. Anyhow, my position is that anything that takes young people away from organized religion's got to be pretty good. Well, Jews in Britain are getting a little nervous. I don't know whether I read this to you before or not, but the British Jewish community is suffering a crisis of confidence, its sense of security shaken by the anti-Jewish backlash triggered by the Gaza war. It's not a war, it's a turkey shoot. The last month has produced a spike in recorded anti-Jewish incidents in Scotland, more than 1 week alone than in the whole of last year. Synagogues have been defaced. The protest was even planned, though later called off, opposite Cambridge Synagogue. Signs comparing Israel to Nazi Germany have been depressingly commonplace. A branch of the grocery store Sainsbury briefly removed its kosher section for fear the food would be destroyed by protesters outside, as had happened in other supermarkets. Whoa. Together, these events have left many Jews scratching their heads, bewildered. It would hardly be an exaggeration to say that they have triggered a potentially debilitating collapse of morale. The sense of anxiety was most visible at the town hall-style meeting 2 weeks ago, in which the community leadership was attacked for its failure to lead. The hope that life will continue as usual, including freedom to retain and celebrate ties with the Jewish state, have been shattered. Like I told you before, the left wing has done, and the progressives on the Jewish issue have done more to reinvigorate anti-Jewism than the right has done in 20 years. The media have begun to treat anti-Jewism in Britain as a major story, with coverage of its gracing the front page of the Sunday Times. The Guardian reported that the rising anti-Jewism in Europe is the worst since the Nazis. An editorial insisted that Jews should not be required to declare their distance from Israel as a condition for admission into polite society's tolerance towards Jews was now a test for us all. Such media attention confirms that the fear of anti-Jewism is not just a creation of our community's own paranoid minds. Britain's most prominent Jewish journalists have written about their anxieties. For Times editor Daniel Finkelstein, British Jewish life represents a high point in Jewish civilization. Yeah, on the back of the British people. But now, for the first time in life, he worries about walking to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah. A member of the House of Lords, he admits he would be lying if he said he did not understand that the niggling effect that might be a good idea to keep a suitcase packed. Well, that sort of goes along with what I've said about big-time politicians and corporate leaders. They don't want to walk on a, they have to be careful walking on the sidewalks now, or even in a car, or even in a protected, bulletproof car, because things are heating up. Columnist Hugo Rifkind, previously comfortable as anything in non-Jewish British society, the son of a former foreign secretary, wrote that he feels lonelier as a Jew today than when he was the only Jew at school growing up. In The Guardian, Hadley Freeman warned Europe that some of its roots are showing, insisting that nobody has the right to tell Jews what to think about Israel. In The Telegraph, woman editor Emma Barnhart broke her journalistic silence on Israel to write that she now feels scared to talk about Israel as a British Jew because the situation on the continent is just so ghastly. Well, you see, the Islam has done more to raise the anti-Jewish stuff than anything that the right or anybody else has done in the United States. They've brought it to fever pitch. The younger generation feels this too. Oxford student Richard Black has written that he feels like a stranger in his own country. Quote, if we Jews wish to continue to live happy lives in Britain, then it must come at a price of publicly disassociating ourselves from Israel, unquote. Warwick student Jordan Jacobs has said that his fantasy of living a normal British life with the added advantages of being Jewish has been crushed, unquote. Well, I've said, and many rabbis have said, and people on both sides of the argument have said, the Jews should have never established a central state like Israel. They had much more power in the long run when they were in different countries all over the place and they achieved political power inside those countries. Like I said, with war or the insurgency, we don't want a central camp or location or anything like that. You want your people to be spread out all over the place. Activists held a protest outside the Tricycle Theater for refusing to host Jewish Film Festival, as it has for years, after objecting to the festival receiving funding from Israeli embassy. It is a sign of the times that, with the exception of public celebrations, this was the first Jewish public protest not specifically about Israel, as far as Mark Gardner of the Community Security Trust can remember, since the Soviet and Iraqi Jewish Jewry campaigns decades ago. Well, let me tell you something. The reason it hasn't boiled over here, there's a very good reason, because here is where the Christian Zionist and Jew Christianity has the greatest power in the world, especially when it comes to being pro-Jewish in the United States. Now, you haven't seen a big outgoing on the streets criticizing Israel, but I believe as it grows in Europe, it's going to grow here. It's going to be quite interesting to see some of the different players that get involved with that, which I don't think that organized religion is going to be able to stop. Unsurprisingly, many British Jews, including this writer, have contemplated packing up and leaving. Where are you going to go? You know Israel's not going to last forever. Are you kidding? Israel's going to gradually fade. You wait and see. Take it to the bank, says Tommy. In the Jewish Chronicles, extremely unscientific straw poll, 63% of Jews said that their friends had discussed whether there is a future for Jews in the UK, unquote. That's a big change in only maybe 5-6 years. Since recent hostilities began, one should ordinarily discount a survey of 150 people randomly approached in the street, but few would be surprised by this figure, which approximate numbers in France. The Jewish agency says it's too early to tell whether recent events have had any measurable impacts on Aliyah rates from the UK immigrating back to Israel. As the authors of the letter in Jewish Chronicle criticized the poll point out, anxiety generally subsides after spikes during conflict. Let's see what I say. Conflict always causes either good things or bad things. It is distinctly possible, they write, that attitudes have shifted since the last rigorous poll in 2010, revealing that events in Israel had left a quarter of the British Jews feeling uncomfortable in Britain. But such a dramatic shift is unlikely to be permanent. Nevertheless, there is a sense that this time is different. The community will emerge either energized or demoralized, but certainly not unmoved. For better or worse, this will mark a major milestone in the history of British Jews. So there you go. There are so many Islamics now in Europe, in France and England and even Germany and so forth, that there's no escaping what's going to happen as they multiply and they become stronger in Europe, which we're not for that either. But on the other hand, I think it may make people come to grips with the fact that it may be better to let the Islamics war on Jews and war on even Christians. In the long run, it may be our best way out, because we have nothing to gain by supporting the Jews, and we have absolutely nothing to gain by supporting the Christian religion and the Hagees and all these people. Anything that brings those people down is fine. Anything is fine. But as this Islamic influence grows in the United States and this from the left anti-Jewish feeling grows, it's going to be very interesting to see the right wing wanting to go to war with these people to protect the Jews. It's going to be a complicated situation, and it's going to be interesting, and hopefully I can have something to do with the way it goes. I have no confidence at all in the right wing conservative neocons or even the Christian oriented right wing that are so critical of Jews. When it comes down to the wire, I think they can't be trusted. It would be interesting to know how much control Putin may have on a lot of these so-called Jews that immigrated out of the Soviet Union and aren't Jews at all, and whether Putin, what he might be expected to do in the future, or maybe he'll do nothing. You know, all you hear about now in the last few days is all these Europeans and Americans that are going over there to fight with the Islamists and ISIS. Well, so what? There are hundreds of Americans that go over and fight for the IDF in Israel. So what's the difference? What is the difference? What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If they should outlaw it one way or another, outlaw it for everybody. But they're not going to do it for people going to fight for the IDF, only the people going to fight for ISIS. And the system in Washington is totally blowing the understanding of ISIS. They're not going to eliminate ISIS. They may break it up in different sections and so forth, but this thing is going to keep moving. And just a few aircraft bombings and stuff like that is not going to stop millions of fanatics that decide to march any more than there was nothing they could do when Genghis Khan took his men across Asia and into Europe. Nobody could stop him. And so just remember that. You can have all the bombs you want, all the planes you want, all the ships you want. It's not going to stop it, because it's built on religious fanaticism. And once that gets ahead of steam, it's like the Crusades, when we kept sending our people, thousands of people kept stupidly going down to the Holy Land to find Jesus' burial ground and all that kind of nonsense, even sending thousands of children down there in the Children's Crusade, just as crazy as Islamic. So don't blame the Islamics for being nuts. Christians are just as nuts. And well, I think that's about it. I'm at the end of my blow off and system here, and I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave, man. What do you think? I don't get enough comment. You know, it really pisses me off, because I'm on here blowing off, and people want to take me to the woodshed. Fine, if they say it's okay, fine. If it's good, okay. But I'd appreciate more comment. We do get some good comments, but we need more good comments so we can sort of find out or decide, are we doing things right, or are we wrong? I guess because you send your $20 in, you're not in serious disagreement with me. So anyhow, I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday, one of my favorite days, Thursday, 14:05, and watch out, ISIS is coming. You see, these stupid politicians are saying that kind of stuff. They should keep their mouths shut because, you know, they said Al-Qaeda's coming and all that. Well, Al-Qaeda didn't come. But they keep whistling past the graveyard. And that ISIS, you don't want that ISIS to come because if the ISIS contingents get here, you're going to be sad, a very sad person, because they'll throw themselves into the battle without worrying about their lives or anything else. And these soft, mostly white, liberal Christians won't stand a chance. If they had a contingency of a few hundred of those guys over here, they'd march through these Christians like a hot knife through butter. Anyhow, that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow. 14:05 and shut up. Oh, incidentally, I was going to answer about the cop. Well, we have a problem with the cop. We can't come out and support system cops. Now, just because they're beating over the heads of blacks in the black community and there's black crime doesn't mean I'm going to rush out there and support cops. The black struggle is in the black areas and the black towns and the black urban areas. That's not our struggle. But I want to tell you something. I can prove with the lumps on my head how I've been treated by cops over the years when I was started out as a total support to cops guy. Support your local police and keep them independent. But when I ran the Klan, I found out real quick that these white cops were even worse towards us than the non-white cops. And they lied to us. Every time we'd do anything, these cops would lie to us. And in Oceanside, California, I could have had some of my men killed because the cops got in between and didn't get in between and covered for 200 of these screaming bastard Reds that were trying to kill us, and the cops weren't doing a goddamn thing but chasing us. And all the infiltration and everything, I'm telling you, boys, don't expect me to come out supporting the cops as a group of people. I'm not saying every cop is bad, and I'm not saying every cop is good. I don't care. The system, cops, collectively, are not for us. They're not on our side. They may talk about niggers when they get drunk and in their homes and stuff like that, but they're not on our side. They're system. They're going to follow the orders of the people who write their checks and sign their checks. So I want you guys to understand, just because the cops are beating on the heads of niggers, that I'm going to come out and say, oh, they're great cops. Not going to do it. Sorry, boys. Not going to do it.
Good to be with you. June said she knew there'd be some people from the South here tonight, because some of you guys get out here in California, that place is so crazy, you just got to get something to eat some way, don't you? I'm glad to see you again. Breathe it to nobody, 'cause you know I'm on the lam. Won't
Wanted Man by Lucy Watson. Wanted Man by Jeannie Brown. Wanted Man by Nellie Johnson. Wanted Man in this Texas town. Well, I've had all that I wanted of a lot of things I had, and a lot more than I needed of some things that turned out bad. Get myself a map. Went the wrong way into Juarez with Juanita on my lap. Then I went to sleep in Shreveport. Woke up in Abilene, wondering why the hell I'm wanted at some town halfway between. Wanted Man in Albuquerque. Wanted Man in Syracuse. Wanted Man in Tallahassee. Wanted Man in Baton Rouge. There's somebody set to grab me anywhere that I might be, and wherever you might look tonight, you might get a glimpse of me. Wanted Man in California. Wanted Man in Buffalo. Wanted Man in Kansas City. Wanted Man in Ohio. When you've been living hell to me, you blistered me since 1963. I've seen them come and go, and I've seen them die. And long ago I stopped asking why. San Quentin, I hate every inch of you. You cut me and you scarred me through and through, and I'll walk out a wiser, weaker man. Mr. Congressman, you can't understand. What good do you think you do? Do you think I'll be different when you're through? You bend my heart and mind and you warp my soul. Your stone walls turn my blood a little cold. San Quentin, may you rot and burn in hell. May your walls fall and may I live to tell. May all the world forget you ever stood. And may all the world regret you did no good. San Quentin, I hate every inch of you.
Incidentally, when this album was cut in 1969, almost everybody in the audience was white at San Quentin.